The next three lectures are going to be reflections on some biblical text. I don't know if all of you have heard of this book. It's a collection of books, actually, 66 books, split into two parts, Old Testament and New Testament. It's authored by the Creator. I'll find one. If you don't have one, I'll find one for you. If you don't have one, I'm willing to. We can wait 3, 4, 5 minutes for people to go get them. Or that's a good idea. Let's get them from the chapel because I think it does help. I'm going to be referring to the text. Yeah, and if any here never read it before, I'd be happy personally to buy you one.
It's been reviewed.
It's been reviewed. It's alongside the Shack, it's going to be a bestseller, I'm sure. yeah, Richard Burton, I think they've, yeah. Good.
Have they reprinted that yet, the Shack?
Reprinted, yeah.
Have they done that yet?
Yeah, I see it all over the world now. It's in airports, and that's the amazing thing, is just the exposure it's had, yeah.
Andrew, it's great to be able to go onto the internet, modern technology, and to listen to Francis Schaeffer and people like Andrew Fellows as well. And
don't mention me in the same breath as Schaeffer. That's a bit intimidating. Yeah.
If people haven't found the Labrie Library.
Yeah. Yeah. But we call it it's on our Labrie website, and there's a link on the front or a little picture or something. I can make it work. If I can make it work, anyone can. I think we call it the Digital Ideas Library. And 300 of Schaeffer's lectures are recorded there. And many others too, yeah. A lot of the Schaeffer stuff isn't in books. It's so valuable. It's, yeah.
And that's, are you using the word
advisor? Free, yeah. Does that appeal to you, Hamish?
Even more.
Go back and download it. That's right, yeah. But, I mean, we were praying this morning about the access people have to internet material. My prayer for this, but many other things too, but for this material is that it would get through to people like Muslims in countries where they're fairly, you know, close to the gospel. And I think one of the attractions of the Labrie Lectures Library is just the diversity of topics. I often say when someone comes, well, just look at the tape catalog. And you often think Christian organization, it's going to be doctrine or Bible. But there are key parts of it. But there's no subject under the sun that isn't dealt with somehow. We're weak on economics, Jeffrey. So if you want to come down and tell us a few things about economics, that'd be great. Because that's, in a sense, partly how we work. We're networking with people who have thought about subjects. So that you know, if they see the library, and it's set up in such a way that you just see all these various sections of the library, showing people it's very comprehensive as Christianity. It's the truth. Mm. Right. So I want to talk now about Jesus, and here I want to focus on Jesus as a subversive apologist. And I'm interested in subversive apologetics because I think it's the most critical type of apologetic that we in the West need to engage in today. One of the things that can be misleading in a course like this is that you pick some things up in this kind of environment and think, oh, I can do this, it's not too hard. But actually the practice of apologetics is so much more difficult than learning things on a whiteboard, isn't it? It's really difficult to really engage someone who's not a Christian for the truth, for the gospel. And I'm increasingly convinced that the ultimate apologist, the master apologist, was Jesus. And studying the gospels is so fruitful to see how he engaged people for the gospel. He's the master apologist. Now, just before I open up and look at Jesus as a subversive apologist, I want to just outline three basic stages that are part of the apologetic process. And forgive me if it feels a bit, again, like a system. The reality is not as neat as this, or what I'm going to present now. It doesn't work like that. But for the purpose of thinking about things, it's helpful to systematize a bit. So there's three stages that I want to talk about in the apologetic process. The final stage is proclamation. So I'm going to start where we end. The final stage of the process is proclamation. And the proclamation involves the telling forth of the gospel. And that actually is what all apologetics should be leading towards. We want to proclaim the truth of the gospel to people so they can, through Christ, come into the kingdom of God, be restored from here to a relationship with their source, their maker. And we must never forget this is the goal. My problem is that many evangelicals see this as the only stage of our engagement with non-Christians. Proclamation is everything. It becomes the whole task, and we fail to see there are important stages which precede the final one. So that's the first proclamation as a final stage. The middle stage is persuasion. And this stage of persuading someone is a dialogue between two persons of differing worldviews. The Christian, you the apologist, and the non-Christian, who stands in another worldview. Now, in order to engage in persuasion, it seems to me vital that the non-Christian we're engaging with is at least open to conversation. So unless there's some openness, you can't have a real type of persuasive conversation. So because they're open, you can bring the reasons why Christianity is true, and you can begin to try and convince, hence the idea of persuasion. And I think this is traditionally where apologetics is focused, on the persuasive stage. I think there's a prior stage, a first stage today, that we need to take very seriously, which I call subversion. It's a dangerous word in some ways. It doesn't mean to tell lies and to be a spy. It simply needs to come up from underneath and to try and enter a world that's closed. So in the subversive stage, we're dealing with someone who is completely closed to Christianity. They have no interest in Christianity, they have no perceived need of Christianity, and they're completely entrenched within their old worldview and are not interested in anything else. Now, most of the non-Christians we work with today are in that category, aren't they? They're completely closed. And these people need what I'm calling subversive apologetics. They need to be moved out of their entrenchment. And that's what I want to focus on in this lecture. And I think it's the most difficult of the apologetic challenges. You can work in the middle stage persuasion, and if you work hard enough, you can really get good answers and good ways to convince. But it's much more difficult to deal with someone who's just completely closed. And I think many Christians just resign themselves to failure with that kind of a person. We just can't do anything, so we have to move on and find someone who may be open. But I actually think we have to deal apologetically with the closed. Now, the closed or the entrenched can take two kinds of forms. Someone who's entrenched can be just outright hostile towards Christianity. They feel threatened by it, and they actually shut it down in quite an aggressive way. That's one form of entrenchment. The other form is just pure indifference. That's the one I tend to meet within Europe. People who are just totally indifferent. When they come to Libri, they're not indifferent. It's a great privilege of our work there. But normally you deal with indifferent people. I'm fine, thank you very much, just as I am. What? You know, they're indifferent. So I'm interested with how Jesus dealt with entrenched people, and how he acted as what I call a subversive apologist. And what I love about the Gospels is that they show lots of encounters with this type of person. I have a little bit of a thing, maybe it's just pure jealousy, about what I call airplane stories. You hear the big apologists, and they always have an airplane story, I find. And they get on a plane with someone, and they travel, and by the end of the 7-hour flight, the person gives their life to Christ. I don't have any airplane stories. I don't have a one. And the few times I have engaged, it hasn't gone anywhere like that at all. Is it 9 hours and 30 minutes?
Well, that's what we learned.
Oh, right, okay. That's right. yeah, I think someone who's entrenched, it might take a little bit more than 9 hours and 30 minutes. That's the point. Now, the entrenched that Jesus dealt with were stuck in what we might call a worldview of Second Temple Judaism, or first century Judaism, which was very particular worldview that they grasped hold of in a very intense way. First century Jews were under Roman occupation. That's the context for the Gospels. And that occupation of the Romans made them even more stuck within their own worldview. So they clung on more than ever. The whole way of life of Judaism was threatened because of the Roman occupation. So they modified how they stood in their worldview, clung to it, and boy, it was hard to break down. That's what Jesus came into. And Jesus comes with a message of something which is very different. It challenged the dominant worldview of first century Judaism. And most Jews rejected it completely. As you said this morning, Rob, Jesus was not a particularly successful evangelist. I'm not sure he would have had an airplane story to tell. There were some who followed, but few, to be honest. So how did Jesus interact with those kind of people? Well, I think one of the classic examples is in Luke chapter 10, verse 25 to 37 is what we're going to look at. And this is Jesus' encounter with a lawyer, an expert in the law. And then, as part of it, he tells the parable of the Good Samaritan. So the context, verse 25, an expert in the law, a lawyer, stood up to test Jesus. And he asked the question, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" So Jesus is actually confronted here by someone who's an expert in Torah. Torah shapes his worldview. And he comes to test Jesus, and in verse 29 it says he wanted to justify himself. That's an entrenched person. Typical marks of entrenchment. Now Jesus' engagement with this lawyer had three subversive elements to it, which I think we can learn from in terms of our own work with entrenched people. And that's what I want to go through now. First of all, the first subversive element we see is that he worked within the other person's worldview and subverted his dominant symbol. The dominant thing that held it together, he subverted it. So he stepped into the worldview of the lawyer and subverted what was dominant there, which held it together. So let's just go through it. Verse 25. The lawyer tests Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus came back with a question, "What is written in your Torah?" he replied. "How do you read it?" Now, a surface reading of this text seems to reveal that Jesus completely blew an opportunity, doesn't it? Here's an evangelistic opportunity which most of us will never have in our lifetime. It's handed to him on a plate. This guy comes and says, "How do I become a Christian?" That's the equivalent. And you look at Jesus' response and you say, why didn't he let him have it? The four spiritual laws. My friend the lawyer, God loves you. My friend the lawyer, God has a wonderful plan for your life. And then, you know, go through it. I'm slightly joking, but that's what you would have thought he did. And actually, on the surface reading, you think Jesus actually blew it so badly as an evangelist, we need to take him off the evangelism task force and make him a Sunday school teacher or something. He doesn't look like he did very well here. Why does he point this man to the law? Well, here we need to understand that the lawyer's question is not as straightforward as it first appears. The question, "What must I do to inherit, to gain, to earn eternal life," is really asking this. He is a Jew, lived in the promises of God, in the covenant of God, which the way they interpreted it, they interpreted this in a very political manner. So he's really asking, what do I have to do to be part of the victory which our God is going to bring? And this victory is going to come when he delivers us from the occupation of Romans and reestablishes Jerusalem as the center of the world. Every first century Jew had that hope and stood in the promises of God like that. The promises of God will be reflected when he reestablishes Jerusalem as a central political entity and gets rid of the Romans, overcomes this huge empire. That's what's behind his question. That was the hope of every Jew of that time. That was eternal life. Tom Wright does a wonderful job of reflecting that this is what this means. So for them, all the promises of their God, all the promises of Yahweh, pointed to that event when the Lord would step back into history and get rid of the Romans. So eternal life was a political reality, which would enable them to take their rightful place on the world stage. And this lawyer is testing Jesus to how he thinks the victory of God is going to come. And that's because he hears in Jesus' teaching something about a kingdom which is very different to their perception. So he's going to test Jesus on his view. So in verse 26, Jesus meets the lawyer on his own ground. He steps into the lawyer's worldview. And he did that because every Jew believed that Torah and the keeping of Torah was the thing which would enable them to be part of Yahweh's victory. The Torah was everything. The Torah defined Jewish identity. They were people of the Torah. And actually, it was the keeping of the Torah, the honoring of the Torah, that made them different from everybody else. So the lawyer was in this framework. My identity, it actually became part of the identity of the heart, is Torah. And that's why Jesus goes directly to Torah. And he says, well, what's your Torah about? Because he knew this guy's thought. Torah, keeping Torah, is how we're going to participate in God's victory. So he goes right into his worldview. Now the lawyer's response to Jesus' question is very predictable. Every good Jew would have said the same. So he answers Jesus' question, what's written in your law? How do you read it? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. I said, every good Jew would have said the same. Then in verse 28, Jesus comes back and says, good answer. He affirms his worldview. Do this and you will live. That's a rather unpredictable response, isn't it? I think the problem with a lot of apologetics today is it's so predictable. I love what Jesus does. He basically says, good answer. Yep, go do it. Now, initially, that looks like a conversation stopper. But Jesus knew that the conversation wouldn't stop there. Jesus senses some kind of agitation in the lawyer, and he plays on that agitation. Not as a game, not playing a game, but he plays on it as in, this is where subversively I can rattle something in order to open this guy up to a conversation. That's a subversive element at work. So in verse 29, Jesus anticipates this is going to come. He wants to justify himself. So he asks Jesus, and who is my neighbor? You see, loving God for this lawyer was obvious. You just love him with all that you are. You keep the law. But it's the issue of loving neighbor which needs clarification. This is the question, who is my neighbor? And here we have to appreciate a bit of background. For every first century Jew, only a Jew could be your neighbor. It's actually what Torah did. Torah ensured an absolute boundary marker against foreigners to preserve their Jewish identity. So, a Gentile could never be your neighbor. Only a Jew could be your neighbor, and that was held together by Torah and their additions to Torah. So the Torah was used as a marker, a boundary marker, against Gentiles. It functioned as an identity which excluded non-Jews. And it's actually similar today in many parts of Judaism. That's how Torah works. So the lawyer wants to justify his position because he senses Jesus is challenging it. Something in the teaching of Jesus challenges this central tenet of Torah worldview. And actually you see this in Luke 4. Luke 4 verse 29. Actually preceding this, Jesus is talking about the widows in Israel in Elijah's time. There's a severe famine. Yet Elijah wasn't sent to any of them, the Jewish widows. He was sent to a widow in Zarephath, in the region of Sidon. That's non-Jewish territory. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only the non-Jew, Naaman the Syrian. Wow. God loves non-Jews. Look at the response. This is first century Jewish response. All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. This is pretty aggressive, I find. They got up, drove him out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill in which the town was built in order to throw him down the cliff. I've had a few people respond aggressively to me in talks, but never anything like this. And he walked right through the crowd and went on his way. He touched the sensitive nerve, huh? Well, he's touching this idea that God, the God of the Jews, would have anything to do with non-Jews. The Torah was a boundary marker against them. That's the point. And yet, Jesus is coming along and he's saying, I'm establishing a kingdom which breaks down this barrier. The barrier you first century Jews have erected. There is no absolute boundary marker between Jew and Gentile. So that's in the background to the lawyer's question, who is my neighbor? In the lawyer's definition of kingdom, only a Jew could be neighbor. It's a deep form of nationalism. It's part of their worldview. In Jesus' kingdom, there's completely different boundary markers. It just shatters that worldview. So it's important to see that the lawyer asked this question because Jesus met him on his own territory. That's a subversive act. Jesus, boom, stepped right into his worldview and he took up Torah on his own terms, subversively, which then led to this series of questions. But then Jesus goes on to answer the question the lawyer asked, who is my neighbor, by telling a story. And the story we all know well, a Jew gets mugged in a country lane, he's left for dead in the ditch, priest goes by, keeps going, a Levite goes by, keeps going. Later, a non-Jew, a Samaritan, comes by, he stops and he stoops and he saves them. That's the story, very simple plot. Then in verse 36, after the story, Jesus asked a question, which of these three do you think was a neighbor, to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? And in the answer in the context of the story is only one. The Samaritan, the non-Jew, was the neighbor. See what Jesus has done. So what he's done here, the Lord is the master apologist, is engage in a devastatingly subversive act. He's deconstructed a key component of the Jewish worldview, the Torah. It's the center of the Jewish worldview. The lawyer saw the Torah as a defense against Gentiles, the boundary marker that stands between them. And here in this story, Jesus destroys the boundary. He undermines the whole Torah as it was used by Jews in the first century. And he does this by showing that the real neighbor to the Jew was a Gentile. And the other Jews in the story failed to be a neighbor to their fellow Jew. So you see how he subverts Torah by being in his worldview. He highlights it being flawed in terms of how it was used, how it was added to. And then in verse 37, he goes on and says, go and be like the Samaritan. Go and behave like the Samaritan, the non-Jew, who knows what neighborliness is about. We'll come back to that in a moment. So I think there's an incredible model here. I think we need to begin our engagement with people within their worldview. And that means, firstly, a sensitive appreciation to what that worldview is. And if we're going to understand a person's worldview, it means listening has to be upfront. Too much evangelism and apologetics is about telling. We have to learn to listen so we can discern the worldview of other people. And then once you begin to gain an understanding of a person's worldview, you have to look for key symbols, key elements of it that you can begin to subvert and question and show the weaknesses of. So the people we're working with today are largely within a modernist worldview. I called that yesterday modern pagan dualism. One of the key components of modern pagan dualism is a commitment to progress. Human freedom, which self-determines the world, means we can just keep going up and up and up in terms of progress. It's actually a faith. We have a faith as moderns in progress. We have a faith in the ability of humans in their freedom to mastermind improvement to the world we live in. And actually, we see history as this evolutionary process where we've moved from basic and primitive to much more sophisticated. C.S. Lewis called this chronological snobbery. The further you are along in history, the more sophisticated you are. We become snobs about it. Most of us, I think, act as chronological snobberies. We think that the later you are in time, the more sophisticated we are. We all function like that. Oh, those people back in the 17th century. It's part of our mindset. It's a modernist mindset. And here we are as moderns, surrounded by all these symbols of our progress. Look at the skyscrapers. Look what we can do on the internet. Yada, yada, yada. We live longer. We eat longer. We make more money than ever before. Many of these things are true. But I think a subversive apologist will actually deconstruct some of these symbols of progress. I think progress is to the modern what Torah was to the first century Jew. The modern is entrenched within this myth that science and technology are creating a brave new world. And despite some setbacks, we're just going to keep moving forward. We can subvert that. Show that that faith just isn't true. And actually, it's extraordinary that people believe that after the 20th century. 20th century. You need to travel a bit. Go to Belarus. Go to Ukraine, where Yaroslav is from. They have a wall in the Ukraine, in Kiev, in the city, that tells the story of 20th century Ukraine. I couldn't get to the end of it. The numbers, Randall quoted some of them, or Schaefer did. You know, you get to 40 million, and you just think, this is a nation. And you just think, no, I cannot deal with this. It's too much. That's progress. And as you said yesterday, what's going to happen with the Russians in terms of its relationship to Ukraine? You know, we live in a very unstable world. And yet, even in the latest economic crisis, confidence, progress, get our hands on it, around it, we're going to be okay. It's how we function. And I actually think we need to deconstruct it. And actually, I think for moderns, we talked about this at breakfast this morning, the greatest tool we have to bring in is death. Everything is under the reign of death. I think today it's the ultimate subversive tool for apologetics. As I said this morning at breakfast, the modern has an answer for everything except death. Death is a complete embarrassment to us. You know it in the field of medical technology. We can do so much, but we still can't stop people dying. People die. And moderns don't know what to do with that. We're embarrassed by it. We have progress in all these areas, but death. Well, I'd say we have to bring death to the forefront of a discussion carefully. You can be insensitive about it. But I think there are ways we can do it. I don't know, Jeffrey, what you do with this, but I often ask people who are in the economic realm, based in the stock markets. The stock market is however many years old. Some people tell me it's just over 100. Some people say it's 400. Whatever it is, the stock market has, in time, seemed to deny the law of entropy. Entropy is within a closed system. Everything's dying and decaying. But here's something which just seems to go up, 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 up. Now, is this something which is immune from the laws of entropy? Is this something which death isn't going to touch? And I actually don't have the answer. It's a genuine question, but it brings in the whole reality of death into a discussion, because we have faith that the stock market will just keep climbing. I think there's lots of ways we can bring death into the discussion, and the genius of Blaise Pascal's wonderful apologetic Panses is he says that death is the only way to passionate truth-seeking. For someone who's entrenched, somehow you have to introduce the idea of death, because if you really face death, then you take things seriously and start moving. So we have to look at modernity, step into the worldview, and actually bring this idea of death, which challenges progress, unlimited progress, the idolatry of human freedom, which can self-determine life, without any interruption. We could take that up some more, but I just want to look at how Jesus did it here. That was the first subversive thing he used. He stepped into the worldview of this lawyer and subverted a dominant part of it, Torah. The second subversive thing I see here is Jesus' use of story. Jesus' use of story. In verse 29, the lawyer asks a question, as I said, which comes right out of his worldview. Who is my neighbor? And actually, he's a lawyer, and what he wants to do as a lawyer is tempt Jesus to a debate. Lawyers are good at public debating, aren't they? That's what lawyers like to do. Now, if someone asked me this question, if someone asked you this question, I'm wondering how you would respond. Someone tempts you to a debate on the evolutionary thing. I think most of us just enter straight into debate, don't we? That's the invitation here. Go in with both feet, go for your best arguments and try to overwhelm them. But Jesus doesn't do that. And it would have been a mistake here to have just entered this guy on his own territory. And I think there's a little rule we can live by here. When you're dealing with the entrenched, I think a debate always leaves the other a little bit more entrenched, if that's how you engage them. It doesn't lessen it, I think probably tightens it. Even if you win your argument, I think we tend to lose the battle. And they become dug in more than ever. And that's where Jesus' response blows me away. In response to the killer question, which invites the debate, Jesus tells a story. That's subversive. And the story subverts the lawyer's position, who wants a fight. Remember, lawyers feel safer within the context of debate. Now, the kind of story Jesus told was a parable. And actually, all parables function in a subversive way to undermine dominant consciousness. That's how parables work. They're just subversive through and through. They rattle cages. All of Jesus' parables rattled cages. Now, the power of a well-told story is that it draws the listener in. It actually appeals to, well, it uses symbols in terms of communication in the aesthetic aspect. So it creates a whole world that you have to step into as the listener if it's told well. Unlike the debate, which causes here, it's alienation, it's distinction. You believe this, I believe that. The story, you have to step into it. So the story creates a world that the imagination of a listener finds it difficult not to be brought into. So you're pulled into this symbolic world, which isn't your own. And within that world, you step into a narrative where you begin to identify with your imagination. You identify with the characters. So the lawyer is forced to see himself in the light of this story. So when he identifies with the Jew who's in the ditch, he knows who the real neighbor is. Oh yes, that's the Jew, and there's the Gentile, the Samaritan. And I mean, the identification here is if the lawyer had been beaten up, was in lying in a ditch, he would have received help from a Samaritan too. I mean, if I, as an English person, was lying half dead in a ditch, I'd even accept help from a Scot. I mean, if I was really badly hurt, I would, yeah. But probably the Scot would walk by me. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And actually, the lawyer here can also identify through his imagination with the priest and the Levite. It's a brilliantly told story. Because at one level, the priest and the Levite did exactly the right thing. They acted as a Jew. You would expect a Jew to have acted in the first century. Because if they had stopped and helped this guy, they would have become ritually unclean and couldn't have done their job. They would have been debarred from temple service. So it's really a plausible story. The walking by to us just looks horrific. But for a Jew, note they did the right thing. Because his main focus is God, serving God in the temple. And if he touches this body, he's not going to be able to do it for 30 days or whatever. So it's a plausible story. And yet the story shows this ritual for what it is. It's completely detached and lacking in human compassion. It's a flaw in Torah that these guys couldn't stop and do it. But it's all within a story. It's not theoretical. It's told in a story. And I think only a story could have broken through the dominant consciousness on this point. And you sense it's effective. That the lawyer just has to respond. When Jesus says, who's the neighbor? He has to say, well, the one who had mercy on him. He can't quite say the Gentile, but he has to say the Gentile was. So I think in subversive apologetics, we have to employ the power of story, which means we have to use our imagination well. Most of us who are attracted to apologetics are attracted to it on this level. I love ideas. I love working with ideas. But actually, I have to become much stronger here in my imagination and here to be a good apologist. Just a few pointers here on how we can use story. I think there's validity and use of story from our own experience. It can be a helpful way to break through. While the person we talk to might be indifferent to our worldview, they can be drawn into our personal stories. If we tell them with integrity and simplicity, we don't all have a what was it? Who's the Nikki Cruz story? You know, I had never stabbed anybody, so I can't tell that as part of my story. But we all have a story, and I think if we tell it with integrity, we don't have to be dramatic. It can have a huge impact. I think part of the problem in a testimony culture is we have to kind of build it up somehow. Many are turned off by that. They sense that it's not honest. But if we tell our stories with integrity and simplicity, people can identify with our experience as we tell the story. They would say, well, what would I have done in his shoes if I faced that crisis? They make connections to our worlds, which can break down defenses. So this is what Paul does in Acts 27. Paul tells his personal story to Felix, who's really opposed. And the personal story begins to open him up. And at the end he says, phew, you've almost persuaded me. He wasn't persuaded, but it opened him up. So there's real value in that. I also profoundly believe in the use of history as story. Reynolds, in his Rekindling the Vision, it's part of what he does, isn't it? And the Heritage Walk here in Cambridge, you're using story as history. So it's not the rational, just arguments. You're walking through Cambridge. It's an amazing experience. Some of you went yesterday, and you think, you know, in the history of Cambridge, this happened here, and this guy was a Christian, and this is why he did this, and this is why this happened, and his discovery led to this, and this guy was a Christian, and it's just telling a story. It's really profound. It has such an impact. And I think it was really where Schaeffer was at his best, showing that ideas rooted and embedded in history have consequences. So this establishment within Europe, the academic establishment, took on this idea, and actually this then led to this. And with people who are perhaps a little bit more in the on the education side, know a bit of history, I think it's a really profound way to actually use story. So we can draw the listener in and say, this is where we fit into the big picture. This is why Europe is where it is today, because we went wrong over there. So I think history is a profound way and good way to use story. The other thing I mentioned here is the use of film. The dominant media for telling story today is not oral. We're quite impoverished when it comes to oral storytelling. We're much more about stories which are graphic media. And these are the dominant stories of our times. They've replaced the old myths. And these films, which are so dominant today, say so much about the world we live in. And they deeply shape us. They shape the way we use our symbols. A lot of our language is shaped by film. And films deal with all the key issues of our contemporary situation. It's where they're so valuable. As I said the other day, it's not statistical, but I'm sure 80 to 90% of my more meaningful discussions with non-Christians go to film. They use film. And I think we as Christians really have to go for it in this one and watch film and learn how to watch films. I feel I'm still an amateur here, but some of my colleagues in Labrie are just brilliant in teaching people how to watch films. Damaris are doing a great work here. And I actually think if we're really serious about apologetics, we have to be serious about how to watch a film and then how to use it appropriately. And we touched on this in my culture lecture. I think there are inappropriate ways to use films. I'm not a fan of the film clip with the little message that goes with it. I just film. Either use a whole film, but even it doesn't have to be in groups. It's just talking about films. If we've watched the film well, someone talks about Avatar. Yeah, it's interesting. Did you notice this in Avatar? Just bring it up like that. And so I think it's for those who are closed as a subversive apologetic, film is very useful. The third thing I see here in Jesus is his use of questions. His use of questions. Firstly, he stepped into the other's worldview in a remarkable way, and he subverted it from within. His use of story is how he dealt with his closed lawyer, and then his use of questions. I think it's easy to fall into the trap of supposing that apologetics is all about giving right answers. But I think with the entrenched, often the answer just makes for greater alienation. So if we can't use the right answer with the entrenched, what can we do? Well, thankfully, we have the question. And I think the question is one of the most powerful apologetic tools we have. We have to learn how to use questions. Now, questions, by their very nature, are deconstructive. A well-timed, well-formulated question is always disturbing. It shakes the status quo. It wakes people up from their dogmatic slumber. It's interesting. All authoritarian regimes, whether state, whether tribal, whether church, wherever authoritarianism is functioning, there's no place for questions. Why? Because you're kept in control and you're kept nice and static if you don't ask a question. The moment you start to ask questions, it disturbs. You see it in your house groups, don't you? Someone who's there who asks a pretty disturbing question, there's a ripple of discomfort that goes right through that room. Now, we're terrified of that, but actually, there's so much potential in that. Now, it's the same when we bring a question to someone who's not a Christian. I believe questions have the power to break down resistances in those who are entrenched. And that is why Jesus so frequently used questions. Dick Heise at Southborough Libri is finishing up a book on the questions of Jesus. And I've heard some of the lectures. It's just wonderful. I can't wait for him to get it done. Being in Libri, our books don't happen very quickly. But just the different types of questions Jesus used, he's analyzed them in a really helpful way. And actually, he says Jesus asked many more questions than he gave answers. Questions were a key thing because he was dealing with very resistant people. T.S. Eliot called Jesus the stranger who asks questions. Now, I think if we're going to follow the example of the master apologist, we have to come to appreciate the question has a revelatory power all of its own. The question reveals things, brings light in a way answers can't. And that's because the question forces a listener to come to their own conclusion. Rather than this is the answer, which is where the entrenched are wired to just put up resistance, put up walls, the question means they have to engage. They have to embrace something. And I think when someone really engages with a question, they're far more likely then to own an answer. They take up the implications of the answers for themselves if it comes first in the form of a question. I think we really miss this point as evangelicals today. We think, now proclamation is about the forthtelling of something, but we have to use questions. That's my point. And then the person takes up the question for themselves, shakes them, and then they say, well, what is the answer there? Now here in this passage, we see two questions, and I think both of them are so important. The first question here is designed to get the lawyer to embrace his own worldview. So he starts with a question, the lawyer, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And in verse 26, Jesus says, what's written in your law? How do you read it? It's the same question as, what is your worldview? That's what Jesus is saying here. What is your worldview? And I like it because the lawyer is wanting to trick Jesus, and Jesus sees immediately what's going on. So he doesn't just give the answer because he knows he's being tricked, tested. He goes and brings back another question, and the purpose of it is to bring the lawyer's belief system into the open. In effect, he's getting the lawyer to state his own worldview. This is what I believe. And I think this one is a really critical step in of subversive apologetics. We have to bring a person's worldview to the surface of consciousness. And actually, we should never tell someone what they believe. When you say, you're a Muslim, you believe this and this and this, all you've done is caricatured their belief. I've had Muslims for years tell me what I believe. There's an aspect of truth in what they tell me, but it's always a terrible caricature. It's a straw tiger. And we do the same as Christians. Often I hear this, Buddhists believe boom, 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 boom. If you're with a Buddhist, get them to state what they believe. Why would you tell them what they believe? Ask them what they believe. And I think here the question plays a vital role. If we ask them what they believe, we draw it out into the open. That's hugely valuable. Now, sadly, today, many who are entrenched in the context we come from, those who are indifferent, they don't know their belief system and worldview. Everyone has one because of the reason of the heart, but many can't articulate their worldview. And I think here again, the question plays a vital role because it enables people to touch base with their ultimate reality belief for the first time. And that can be a kind of awakening, a kind of revelation. It helps them to become revealed to themselves. And for me, a good conversation with someone could be just that. All we're doing is helping someone to discover their own worldview. We don't even get into the Christian worldview. If someone walks away and says, wow, that's my belief system, this is how I view the world, that is incredible. Something so significant has happened. That is a seed that could quite quickly grow to something which becomes salvation. Just that act right there. Because if someone sees what they believe, because it's not true, they're much more likely, especially if it comes for the first time, to see its inadequacies. Someone who knows what they believe and they've hardened themselves in it and put all the pieces to try and keep it in place, they're harder. But if someone doesn't really know, but they have one, bring it to the surface, they can see quite quickly where the inadequacies are before they start tightening it here and there. That's the point. And at that point, they're more in a place to say, well, why do I believe this? Have I just taken this on board because it's come through the media or through my parents, whatever? It's so valuable, that one there. And they can move beyond their entrenchment. So that's the first question. It's targeted to help a person reveal their own worldview, to bring it out into the open. The second question Jesus asked was designed to get the lawyer to step into another worldview, the truth of the Christian worldview. And that's exactly what his question does. And it's the one in verse 36. He tells the story and he says, which of these three, the three in the story, do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? So the question comes after the story. And by means of the story, Jesus has already engaged him and drawn him in. And then there's a question designed to bring him to a conclusion. So Jesus doesn't say, well, look, at the end of the story. Obviously, the non-Jew was the neighbor. He makes the man say it. He says, and so, who do you think was a neighbor to the Jew? Genius. We just give answers. He force this guy to give the answer, to draw the conclusion for himself. And there is only one answer. The point is, the question forced him to it. And when the lawyer gave the answer, there's only one, the non-Jew was the neighbor, at that point, momentarily, he stepped out of his own worldview. Remember, in his own worldview, the Torah was a boundary against non-Jews. So you couldn't be a neighbor with one? Well, in this story, when he says, the one who showed mercy, which is non-Jew, he, for a moment, stepped out of his own worldview. It fell apart. It's a genius question. For a moment, he had to step out of his worldview. Now, there's no indication in terms of this story that he accepted this worldview. It doesn't tell us that he became a believer, fell on his knees, signed the card, and joined a church. It doesn't say that. I would say begrudgingly, he gave the right answer. He couldn't name him as a Gentile, the one who had mercy, but still It pulled him over. That's what the question did. He crossed over for just a moment. And that's extraordinary. And actually, for me, it shows Jesus really was a master apologist. Just for that moment, in that question, he just stepped out of his own worldview. Now, just as I finish, I want to stress that Jesus, as a subversive apologist, was not playing mind games. Subversion is a very dangerous thing. We don't subvert in order to play games with people's minds and imaginations. It's always with a view to bringing them to the truth. And as we do that, we love them. If you're subverting someone's worldview and you're not loving them, there's a problem. I never met Francis Schaeffer. Sorry we keep talking about him. I don't talk about him this much, but usually. But he's a wonderful example in apologetics. But many have told me, who I've met, who sat with Schaeffer as non-Christians, that as he deconstructed their worldviews, he wept. Because he saw what was happening. He saw that this was going to rattle them to the core of their being. He didn't get some thrill out of just winning the argument. And I've heard it so many times. While he was doing it, he was weeping. He felt the pain of what was going on for this person. And they said that was a huge part of it. As he intellectually dismantled my worldview, I could feel his love in the tears. And the master of that wasn't Francis Schaeffer, it was Jesus Christ. The love that he had for this man, which was never lacking. I want to finish with a few lines from a poem by T.S. Eliot. This is, my mind's just gone blank. Which T.S. Eliot poem is this from? Hang on, from the Four Quartets, thank you, yes. I love this. The wound is a spoke, Christ. The wounded surgeon plies the steel, scalpel, that questions the distempered part. Beneath the bleeding hands we feel the sharp compassion of the healer's art, resolving the enigma of the fever chart. So the scalpel is painful. Jesus, as a subversive apologist, was going right for the heart of this guy's worldview. He just dismantled it, like a surgeon. But I love what's going on with the hands here. The wounded surgeon plies the steel that questions the distempered part. Beneath the bleeding hands, those hands of the surgeon themselves have bled for us. That's the extent of his love. Beneath the bleeding hands, we feel the sharp compassion of the healer's art, resolving the enigma of the fever chart. And if we don't do subversive apologetics in the spirit of our master, it's dangerous. So I believe passionately in subversive apologetics, but I'm worried what some people could do if they were let loose with this, if they didn't do it in love. So Christ is the master. And Eliot, I think, expresses that beautifully in this poem. So I think there's an example there of subversive apologetics and how we can do it today. Stepping into other worldviews, using story, and the one I'm most intrigued by is the use of questions. Let's open it up then, and we've got half an hour. Noel?
There's another way of using story too, and there's more of a movement in the States than there is in the UK. It's just biblical storytelling, where people learn by heart chunks of scripture and tell them a story.
Yep.
And that can be very powerful because it speaks to, the emotive side.
Yeah, and the imagination, yeah.
I learned the book of Jonah off by heart. I've told it the story on a number of occasions. And, just to say, to quote what Jesus says about the people of Nineveh, they repented for preaching of Jonah.
Yeah.
And now one greater than Jonah is here and just leaving.
Cool.
Tell a story.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what you guys feel. Something shifted in the last 5 years. There's still many people, the Bible comes out and they just knee-jerk reaction against it. But I think the people are so biblically illiterate now that when you tell stories from the Bible, they're hearing them for the first time. Now, this is with children, but our neighbor, Ken Cope, works a good chunk of his week in schools doing assemblies. It's wonderful work. And he says, it's amazing. You know, just telling the David and Goliath story. And he's a storyteller. Acts it out and does the whole thing. And he says, it's obvious when it's a new class. They're hearing it for the first time. And he says now at Easter, when he really does the passion narrative, the crucifixion, and the kids, you're just all on the edge of their seat. And what happens to him next, they say? And he does the resurrection bit, and it's completely new, and their minds are blown by it. I think that's true for many, many, that we now are able to use the Bible creatively in a way that it was hard a few years ago because there was just such a resistance. Bible equals keep it away. So I think it's really helpful. I find it at Labrie with non-Christian, I can just say, well, let's study a passage of the Bible together. Whereas that would have made some gag when I first started. Most gag is sort of, don't you beat me with your Bible. That's my whole problem. That's why I'm here. Something shifted, I feel. But do you guys sense that? We have to be discerning, but... Yeah.
But what actually, the fact that the Bible is connected,
yeah.
The fact that I mean, they might, even if they do know some bits,
yep.
Even if they do know about some of the stories, the narrative structure, the fact that it's a coherent unit,
yep.
Is complete novelty.
Yep.
Because if they have ever heard anything on the Bible, it's always, you know, Scavenger effect.
Yep.
And so you can open it up, and if you open it up in narrative, it is profoundly effective.
Yeah. I remember years ago a guy who asked, we're talking, doing apologetics, philosophy, and he kept saying the Bible was nonsense. So I said, well, read it. So I sent him away with a Bible, and I didn't see him for a while. Got back together, and he raised it. He said, oh, I'm enjoying the Bible. And I went, fantastic. That's so hard. And I said, so what are you reading? And he said, Revelation. And I thought, Andrew, you idiot. Why didn't you take that, rip that out of the Bible or tell him to read something else? It was the last book I wanted him to go to. And I was so humbled, because the first thing he said is, he was a bright guy. He said, it's like science fiction. And actually, he's right. If you, all the vivid metaphors, and there is a narrative there, he just immediately was attracted to it. And then he said, and yeah, it was just so clear for me. And I joke with him. I said, well, it's funny. A lot of great commentators in church history have not even bothered to comment on it because they don't think it's clear. So I said, well, what did you get from it? He said, well, it's quite straightforward. It just says you guys are going to win. And I thought, that's Revelation, isn't it? It's as simple as that. That is what the text is doing. It says we're going to win. So I thought, here we are trained to dissect the Bible and interpret it, and this guy just read it once, and it's like science fiction. I liked it. It connected with me there. And he got the plot. Yeah. Fiona. Yeah. Yeah.
I've got a number of friends who have very rich lives in very many ways and very sort of happy, good lives. But I'm not quite sure how you would kind of begin to kind of, I don't know how you use, you know, the fact that we are all going to die. I don't know how you can use that in a sort of sensitive way that isn't a complete freak of
the crowd. I know. Yeah, I struggle with it too. The prophets in the Old Testament didn't seem to be terribly sensitive. The message of ending had to come of kind of a thunderbolt to break them out of their comfort zones. And it's the only thing that breaks the comfort zone is the message of death. And sometimes I find myself stating it quite strongly. You know, when you see people plot their life dreams that doesn't have any place for death in it, just sort of, wait. Where someone said today, oh, is Jenny in a hospital, there's a lot of plastic surgery. People who were in their 70s, you know, having the business done to keep them looking young, You know, there's something pretty absurd about that.
Mm-hmm. So would you sort of gently push them towards, you know, sort of where is this all leading?
Yeah. I often quote the film What About Bob? Have you guys seen What About Bob? It's one of my favorite films. And there's a little kid in there who has his death fixation. So you can play it out a little bit. And this little kid just wears black and just is constantly haunted by the fact he's going to die in an instant. And this guy, Bob, who has a psychiatric problem, is in his bedroom and the little kid's sitting there saying, I'm going to die. You're going to die. We're all going to die. But it's so true. It's the absolute truth about everybody. That's where we are. I think we have to get it through. Because the thing about a comfort zone is it needs often a bit of a bomb to get people into reality. And, you know, death is all around us. The problem with media is that it sanitizes death. The blood that we see all the time on our screens never messes our carpets up. So we have a really skewed view of it. I said this morning, I think it's perhaps the greatest satanic conspiracy ever to make moderns deathless. We're embarrassed by it, so we hide it away. But it makes in our consciousness, we just hardly give it a thought. Our funeral rituals are just get them in the ground, don't talk about it, just wind it up and then move on. Yeah. I mean, I think when we are dealing with people who themselves have had to face it, they're already confronted by its reality. But sorry.
No. I was just thinking on that, it's going to be a less tactical, doing more, talk about these things with people. It's just like, you know, if you're having a cup of tea with someone, it's a lovely conversation. But, well, I was thinking about death the other day. What do you think?
Mm.
And just get into the questions and ask them questions.
Yeah.
And with things like euthanasia and all of that around,
yeah.
Like, oh, I saw this in the newspaper, what do you think about that?
Mm.
And just going straight to the questions, not having to think, oh, I've got a prepared speech, when would be the right time for me to roll that out?
Yeah, I think
it's just being brave and getting a question.
I'm with you. I don't find that easy, but I think we have to go for it.
And actually, most people respond quite well. If you're sitting there and being normal, like if you look nervous, they'll probably be nervous.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Martin.
We've all got close relatives, I'm sure, and loved ones who aren't Christians, and it's the most difficult thing to think where they will go, the judgment. And then we water it down, and of course God's all loving, and well, he knows really our hearts, and I'm sure they might have responded in a small way to his love, and so we kind of try and persuade ourselves that they're going to make it. But in the end it comes down to our view of God and his character and his justice.
Yep, absolutely.
God's going to be God, he's going to do his work, and he's holy and he's just.
That's right, absolutely.
But it's the most heartrending thing.
Yep. Yeah, that for me is the key part of the gospel. We're going to do this tomorrow. You cannot bypass judgment. It's just impossible. The subversive thing is starting though with the death thing, because you don't have to, there you start, and if it takes its course in the right way, it will end in the issue of judgment then. But so I'm agreeing with you entirely. And the subversive apologetic is just how you get the death theme on the table. And I looked at the Old Testament prophets. I think we can learn a lot about apologetics from them. And it seems that as quickly as they brought the message of ending, I mean, you Israelites, the people of God, are in your safe, cozy houses. You know, you've got paneled walls, and you just think everything's good. And you guys are going to be nailed by the Assyrians. They're going to come, and they're just going to obliterate you, and all this is coming to an end. So it's a really harsh message of endings, of death. But then they didn't leave people there. They also gave them the message of hope and of a new beginning, or renewed new beginning, with the Lord, and somehow it's how you bring those together. In a sense, Rose, what you're talking about, and what you're thinking about your art, the fractured soul, it's a death metaphor, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yet, how do you reflect also there's hope, there's a way out? And yeah. But I think sometimes just starting with the death thing and leaving it there, to inside, to rattle people and to make them think, yeah, boy, I don't have long here, do I? And what?
I think people can be a bit relieved as well to be able to talk about things like society doesn't allow you to, and then
yeah.
You think within your own circle of friends, who's affected by what, and your own family, and
yeah.
Just thinking they are, or you are. So
yeah.
It's a bit like sometimes I feel like when it comes down, people get the opportunity. It's like a bit of a relief.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
It's a very entertaining poem by Steve Turner.
Hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Called Death Lived. I mean, I can't think of it all, but you know. It's all about the fact that death respects no boundaries.
Yep.
There's no political correctness with death.
Yep.
And the last line is, the great thing about death is we're all going to be it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's a very amusing poem.
Hmm.
What's it called?
Death Lib. It's a liberation.
Yeah.
The advice to the funerals, inviting people to Christian funerals, or when people have to come because their family members died.
Yeah.
Positive comments recently. You know, we've had death in the church. The church has been packed. We've got on a good meal, a good deal for the family.
Yeah.
Non-Christians have attended, and they've been bowled over by kind of family of the church supporting.
Yep.
The loved one who's gone.
That's right.
So there's a first opportunity for the church to
very use them. Yeah, that's reflecting the hope side. That this isn't the end. I agree. I think too, when we talk about death as Christians, in the resurrection of Jesus, boy, the final enemy has been overcome, but it is still the final enemy. So I love the way that's reflected in Bunyan's Pilgrim Progress. You know, there's a wobble when it came to going across the river of death, and I remember in Ian Murray's biography of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, when Lloyd-Jones was approaching death, and Ian Murray looked at the great man and said, "Well, you must be so prepared and ready for this." And he was sternly rebuked by Lloyd-Jones. "Don't underestimate the terror of this last enemy." So I love the hope Christians reflect, but just occasionally I wonder if it's quite realistic to the biblical idea. Paul says, "I want Jesus to come before I die because I don't want to be outside of my tent." You know, he really doesn't want to be disembodied. That's not a natural condition. And I think we also have to reflect in our hope that this is horrible. Absolutely horrible. It's grotesque. And as Jesus was angry when he looked into the tomb of Lazarus, yeah, and saw the death there, he was angry. And we should reflect that too. It's the hope and the horribleness. Any other one to Fiona's question? How do we introduce this? How do we get it on the table?
What mileage is there in terms of, in the problem about the modern, well, one of the problems about the modern view is, there's no source of authority for any ethical or moral behavior.
Yeah.
There's no good in one sense.
Yep, absolutely.
And all there is sort of a legitimacy for selfishness.
Yeah.
I mean, to what extent is it, in terms of questions, is opening that up a way into some of these discussions, because actually people instinctively believe there's a way to behave, there's a way not to behave.
Yep.
But and Dawkins quotes himself, you know, you've shown sort of illustrate this is a really difficult area for them.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been sitting here thinking about, you know, having gone through what Jesus did, saying, well, this is hopeless. I'm never going to be able to match that.
Yeah.
And in terms of, you know, the questions you may come up, you know, the questions you may get into, in the way you describe. But I'm just wondering, is this whole issue of authority for goodness and morals a fruitful way or not?
I think it is. For Lewis, it was central. I think Schaeffer made it quite central too in his idea of moral motions. It's highlighting the contradiction that because we all have this capacity, we're relativist in our theory of ethics, morality and ethics, but actually the moment someone violates our code, it's not fair.
Yeah.
And highlighting and pointing it out. And actually, I like what Paul does in Romans, says, when every time you say that it's not fair, you form a moral absolute. And all God requires is that you live by your own moral judgment on others. And if you can live according, I think that's what Paul is saying, I really do. If you live faithfully to your own moral code, you'll be saved. You'll be just fine. I think there is another way of salvation apart from Christ. We just have to live up to our own moral codes, and no one does it. So I actually think there's a lot of fruitfulness in the moral one. The idea that moderns are amoral is rubbish. Look at every tabloid. Every headline is so moralistic. We're so moralistic about everything. Even as we sort of say, well, you know, do your own thing. It's a massive contradiction. I think. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Some truth to be defended.
Yeah.
People shouldn't be misled.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have our own series of lectures on this, and we've got the biggest kind of, maybe it's there, we're quite vocal, the biggest end up that we provoke was Brian Edwards, who said, you cannot call us amoral, atheists are the most moral. And
yeah.
That's the biggest outrage there was at anything that was said.
Brilliant. But I agree with them. They are moral. They have to be because of what they are. You know, they don't have a basis for their morality, but they are moral creatures. Moral beings have moral emotions.
Yeah, a story from Shapers. But the thing that stuck with most of me over the years since I first read The Church at the End of the 20th Century is the little story in Britain, which is really just an elaboration of what Paul says in Romans 1 and 2. If every little baby that was ever born wrote, the tape recorder hung around its neck and birth, and on that tape recorder was only recorded every time that baby has grew up into an adult, recorded that only their judgments of other people.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, when they meet their maker, they would say, well, what right has God to judge? God would just have to press play.
Yeah.
And say, where do you stand in the light
that's right.
of your judgment?
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
I think there's an interesting thing going on now with that man. What's his name? He's going on about death there and going on about morals and what's right and wrong and the whole internet thing where there's the Facebook page and there's lots of people going, oh, you're a hero, and there's people who are morally outraged at that.
Mm.
And it's just like, I just want to know what everyone thinks about that if we throw that into the mix.
Yeah.
I mean, how...
But there's a story,
yeah.
Contemporary story, that's so easy for us to enter into. Other people have entered into it for us to have a conversation. Our neighbor who died a few years ago, David Porter, he was very, very dedicated to popular culture for that very reason. He watched soap operas and then wrote on them. He said soap operas are dealing with all the main ethical issues of our time. So if no Christians watch soap opera, you lose the opportunity to enter the discussion about abortion, homosexuality, unfaithfulness, you know, multiple sexual partners. They're all being explored in the soaps. I haven't made the choice to watch them, but someone has to. I'm glad he did.
Back in the mid-90s, the Oxford University Christian Union, which have a main evangelistic mission every 3 years, had one called Choose Life. And their posters were in the style of the advertising posters for the film Trainspotters, which was very popular at the time.
Yep.
I can't quote it exactly. I just made a note to myself to key it in on my computer so that I can send what it was to anyone. Brilliant. Choose Life. And then choose a university, choose a subject, choose dysfunctional roommates, choose a nicked alpha that you don't understand.
Yeah, yeah.
Choose it, just right on through the university life.
And then, yeah.
Choose something's CV.
Yeah.
Choose 32,000K to start.
Yeah.
And then on through life, and then choose to be forgotten by all of the undergraduates who replaced you, and then choose life.
Yeah, wonderful.
And the CU couldn't keep the posters up because non-Christian students would nick them and take them and put them on the wall of their room. So the Christian students just happily kept renewing the posters, and happy the more non-Christian students there were with them in the room, the better, the easier it was to talk about the mission and to raise questions.
So the poster itself raised questions in people that they could engage at that point.
And I heard it one way. You say, what are you studying? What are you going to do? Finish university, and then what? I get a job. And then what? Such and such. And then what? Well, I hope I get married. And then what? Well, children. And then what? I'll retire. And then what? Well, maybe I'll be able to travel soon. And then what?
Pushes them to an end.
John Chapman, I Will Spend the Rest of Your Life, is also available in the DVD form. And some of the more senior members in our church have used that quite effectively with contemporaries. A cup of tea and cinema, and have you seen this? But you find your own way of doing it. And I think it has to be done sensitively, and it's probably best done in our experience. And really, three or four people, I'd say contemporaries, ladies with ladies. It's called How to Make the Best of the Rest of Your Life. It's available in the book form. But it's also got a DVD. You kind of have to look at it. I mean, it is Australian, so we have to make allowances. But seriously, there's kind of differences. You know, sometimes we do have things from other cultures. Not everything from the USA comes across the Atlantic quite so well, but I'm serious. It's got humour in it. Chapman is very
Laughing.
That's
Australian.
And that's because it's Australian. And it is sensitive, which is. So that's one of
another big thing was when the whole expenses scandal was.
Yes.
Was
absolutely.
Amazing how many people had pretty strong moral feelings about what's right and wrong.
Yep.
And as an example, if we're judged by those, our own standards of right and wrong.
Yeah.
Never mind what the Bible says. But that's quite a good way of entering in.
This is where the cultural apologetic, our listening to the culture, is so important. I mean, I think we all found the Diana thing 15 years ago. This outpouring of grief, which I think reflected this deathless culture we've become, where we have no medium and ritual to actually grieve our many, many losses. All of us have expressed losses. And then in one event, it was as if this is... of 30 years of loss that we'd all expressed and we put into that event. It spoke a lot to that.
What I found very helpful is when I go and work with the people up in Huntington, up in the office up there, they have Radio 2 on. Jeremy Ryan is just brilliant because it's all the current topics, it's all the issues, they're just there. One day we talk about expenses, the next day about death penalty or abortion, and they're just surgery on a plate, and everybody's listening to it, and it's just to say, what do you think?
We
nearly got on into about the round church has been having some railing with the big controversy, right division. Jeremy Vine show phoned up, and it's not something I wanted to get into debate about.
Perhaps sometime, Andrew, could you give us a list of your top five movies eliminating good debates amongst.
Yep. Okay, well, I'll give that some thought. And yeah,
that's you so far. What about Bob and Loves of the Love Brothers?
Yeah. No, I'd be happy to do that. I, the idea of a mindless film is, there's no such thing as a mindless. There's a lot of bad films about it, but I think almost any film can be used to raise something. I'll give that some thought. What about the type of question that can draw people out to reflect their own worldview? Any practical thoughts on how to do that? Because it can be too general, the question. I think we have to give it a bite, don't we? A focus that begins to enable a person to tell us their belief.
And that obviously, I'm reading quite a lot on worldviews, and a lot of those give you kind of the key questions that discerns on worldview. Sometimes they're a bit obvious to ask, but I think one that's quite, if you want to instigate the conversation, that's quite an interesting one is, what do you think is the greatest problem with our world?
Yes.
And how do you think we can fix it?
Absolutely.
Because then you're asking people about what they're passionate about anyway. Everyone wants to make a difference these days.
Yep.
And I think that's quite an interesting way. You learn quite a lot about someone, but it's quite a nice way to sort of, can we fix it?
Yep.
Is it beyond us, or what are we going
to
do about it?
Because every worldview has a narrative to it. And actually, the narrative structure of every worldview is creation, fall, and redemption. It's not just Christians. We all have to give explanations for where it came from, why it's gone wrong, and how we're going to save it. So that question there actually helps reveal their creation, fall, redemption narrative. As I say, what I did yesterday, I wish we could have gone further with it, but the dualistic paganism, you know, the salvation metaphor is all in that human freedom to engineer our own salvation, redemption.
In arts, what people's plans are for the future, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And stuff. Because it's a kind of scary question, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and you can take it from there, can't you?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, people's dreams. What?
Yeah. Or that.
Yeah.
Create software for your treasure.
Yeah, indeed.
It's a line from William Butler Yeats, sorry. WBS.
Yeah.
So tread softly, will you tread on my dreams?
Mm.
Nice one.
That was a very adamant question, Mike. What people, what values have shaped who you are?
That's
a fairly direct question in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But it could certainly open up if it sort of go anywhere.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, I'm interested to find out what one's view of personhood is, using non-technical language, but I think that reveals so much about a worldview, how they view a person. And there's such a chronic depersonalization of.
They're asking, what's your hood?
Yep. Yeah, I agree. It's funny, Dick Kuys, because that's linked then to meaning. Dick Kuys thinks that we're in a place today, because the meaning of life, it makes a great title for a film, doesn't it? And to really mock the whole idea, the whole question. But he says the suspicion of meaning or non-meaning is everywhere today, and we can start asking people meaning questions. The most mind-blowing lunch table I've had in the last year is someone who wasn't a Christian who said, "What is the meaning of life?" And everybody laughed and told Monty Python jokes. But he was not a Christian, and he came back, no. He said, what is? I want to know the meaning of life. And it's that question, when it's asked right, is whew. But Dick says the meaning vacuum is so huge today that actually a lot of people's questions are around meaning. Because the emptiness people feel is overwhelming. So Blaise Pascal used the happiness thing as the kind of starting point. Humans, he said men, because he wasn't very politically correct. Men are happy, unhappy without God, they're happy with God. Boom, that's the starting point. His whole apologetic was built on that. Happiness. Even that today, there's a lot of writing. Psychologists, sociologists, everyone's writing about, a lot of people are writing about happiness, aren't they? They sense an unhappiness. So we could still use that one, but I think the meaning one works for me. Humans are empty without a relationship to the true and living God, and they're full in terms of the meaning sense with it. So I think the meaning quotient has become quite an important one that our questions can key off.
I'm questioning where people invest, like, most of their time, most of their money, and like most of their energy, really gets to the root of where they're facing identity.
And their hopes.
Yeah.
Investment. Yeah.
So like, just like even like someone asked me that, like, well, what do you spend most of your money on? What do you spend most of your time on? And actually, when you reflect on that, you're like, well, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where am I putting money?
Yeah. Yep. The happiness one, a Swedish guy I know, who's actually a trained psychologist, but he had the nerve to do it, especially in a Scandinavian country. And he just go up to strangers and they get talking. He says, "Are you happy?" He says it led to the most amazing discussions. This is so shocking to people, and some people were angry at it. What are you on, mate? But it's quite a striking question. Are you happy? Because I think people are really unhappy today. Are you happy? No? Why not?